In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with novelist Richard Russo. He's the author of several novels. They are Mohawk, The Risk Pool, Nobody's Fool, Straight Man. They're all available in paperback now. And his newest, which is titled Empire Falls. It's come out now fairly recently. It's published by Knopf and is out in bookstores, so you might want to take a look at it. He's now spending some time traveling around the country talking about the book, and we're pleased to have him with us this morning by telephone. As we talk with Richard Russo, you're certainly welcome to call. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. And anywhere the signal will travel, if it would be long-distance call for you, use the toll-free line, 800-222-9455. Mr. Russo, hello.
Hi, David.
Thanks for talking with us today.
My pleasure.
We appreciate it. The title of the book comes in part from the town in which it's set, Empire Falls, Maine. So maybe we should talk, I should ask you to talk a little bit about Empire Falls. What kind of place is it?
Empire Falls is like a lot of Maine mill towns. It exists, of course, only in the author's imagination, but you can go up just about any river in Maine, and there are a lot of them, and you'll find towns, mill towns for the most part. Many of them actually have the word falls in their title. There's Lisbon Falls and Livermore Falls and all kinds of falls. For the very simple reason that a lot of these towns grew up in pretty much the same way, along about the same time. A lot of them had textile mills, shoe factories, still some logging and paper mills. And before electricity throughout the state, of course, the power that was generated for these various mills was the various falls that came along these rivers. So the mills grew up along the falls, and the towns grew up around the mills. And that's the genesis of a lot of these Maine towns, and of course the title does contain something of an ambiguity too, because not only have all these towns kind of had a similar genesis, but the same thing is happening to a lot of them now. The various mills are. A lot of them are closing. A lot of them, the jobs are fleeing to other parts of this country, but also abroad. And so, a lot of these empires from a century ago and through the first half of this century are now falling in Maine and in a lot of other places as well.
Mm-hmm. And this is one of those kinds of towns where there was one wealthy family. They were the people that owned the factory. They owned a lot of the real estate. They pulled a lot of the strings in the town. And that's also another way in which, another level in which this title works, because this little empire, this family empire, it really is also on the decline. It's also fallen.
Yeah, it's been on the decline actually for some time. The novel opens with the last of the Whitings, is the name of the family that has owned everything worth owning in Empire Falls for a long time. The novel opens with the last of these Whitings, who is a kind of reluctant scion of this family, who would rather live in Mexico and write poetry, but is forced to return to Empire Falls to run the family business of a shirt factory, a textile mill, and a paper factory. He returns reluctantly, and when he decides to build his dream home on the other side of the river from Empire Falls, he sets the events of the novel in motion by redirecting the course of the Knox River, which runs through town, and in doing so sets in motion a lot of the events which will have repercussions long after his death. He is the last of the Whiting males, but his widow is the one who is still at the helm of things during the course of this book.
And at the center of the story is the fellow named Miles Roby, who is managing a grill that's one of the businesses that's owned by the Whiting family. And here's a guy, he's in his early 40s, and his marriage is falling apart. He's got a teenage daughter who is maybe one of the most charming and admirable characters in the book, and he seems to be he's working in this grill and is working there in the hope that the Whiting, the last of the Whiting, will fulfill her promise that she said she'd give him the grill when she died. So he's laboring along in this sort of vague hope that eventually he's going to get the grill, which then he would likely sell and leave town. And he's a guy who really is in many ways he seems to be kind of a lost soul.
Yeah, and he's one of many in this town. And he's also, I suppose, one of many in Richard Russo's fictional worlds up to this point. I've always been fascinated by human destiny, how we end up where we end up, and why. People always think of the future as mysterious. We don't know what's going to happen in the future. We try to predict it, and we focus on it. And admit that it is unknowable. What's always fascinated me is the fact that the past is, in a strange way, almost as unknowable as the future. And Miles, at age 42, is kind of looking around at the town that he didn't expect to be in, the job that he didn't expect to be doing, the woman that he kind of admits that he has never loved as he should, who is for a short time. Longer still his wife, and a man who is trying to figure out not so much the future as the past. How in the world did he come to be here? A man who had a different notion of the future for himself, and a man also who was trying to live up to not only his own notion of what he might become, but his mother's, who had a dream for him as well.
Yeah, it seems to me that that is why I find these characters so compelling, and that is they are all struggling what is, I think for almost everybody, a very real predicament, and that is you're going along through your life, you think that you have some idea where you're going, and one day you just stop and you look around yourself and you say, how did I get here?
Yeah.
And as I say, it seems to me that's a pretty universal human experience, and I can certainly connect with that.
Yeah, yeah. Is it, I don't. I wonder sometimes, is that a boomer question, or does it go beyond? Does it go beyond those of us in that in that particular age group? I think it's more universal than that. But boomers have made the question into kind of a fine art, I suppose. You know, by changing. Never has a generation changed so many careers, so many jobs, so many spouses. And maybe it's just a function. Maybe it's just a function of leisure that we have. The I suspect that older generations in living in a harsher world probably didn't have the leisure to sit back and reflect on how we have managed to make of our lives something so different from what we had intended.
Yeah. I think on another level, again, what I find compelling about these characters is that they seem to be so ordinary. And now, having said that, I would say in other ways they're not. But they do, to me at least, they seem to be people that are pretty easy to identify with.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. They become extraordinary only when we begin to invest ourselves in their predicament. And then they become as extraordinary as any human life is, I think.
Our guest in this hour, Focus 580, is novelist Richard Russo. His newest novel is Empire Falls. It's just recently out. He has also written several others. The one previous to this was A Straight Man, which is set in a college town. It's about a college professor. And then the others include Nobody's Fool, which was made into a movie, The Risk Pool, and Mohawk. He's also done some screenwriting. He was a screenwriter for what I thought was a pretty good movie called Twilight that starred Paul Newman, Gene Hackman, Susan Sarandon, and he's it's said to be working on a screenplay for Straight Man. So he's got, in a sense, two kind of interests, writing novels and writing for the screen. And we're talking about here the story of his most recent. If you have questions, you can call in 333-WYLL, toll-free 800-222-WYLL. It certainly seems to be the case that you have made kind of a specialty out of writing about Rust Belt towns in decline. I think even Straight Man is set in such a place, although it may not be as important a part of the story as Empire Falls, for example. What is it about these kinds of towns that you find so engaging or interesting?
Well, I mean, there's a deep personal connection to it because I grew up in such a town in upstate New York, and there's a way in which those things that happened to us in the first 18 years of our lives remain probably as vivid as anything that happens in the next 50 or 60 thereafter. You know, I'm still pretty deeply connected to people who live in such places and who do the kinds of jobs that the people in my novels do, and the kind of jobs that people in my family and my neighbors did growing up in upstate New York. So I'm connected to it in that way. Small towns also, small towns in general are just interesting, in some ways more interesting, I think, ways of looking at America, a changing America. I don't think anybody would argue that we're witnessing something happening in this country now that's on a par with what happened throughout the world in the Industrial Age, with the coming of the Industrial Age. And there's something we're witnessing here. We're seeing certain kinds of work disappear, certain kinds of places disappear. I was in California recently on this book tour, talking with someone from San Francisco, and he said, you know, he said, I understand what you're writing about with these small towns in New England. He said, but in a strange way, it's pretty foreign to those of us in California. He said I too grew up in a small town. But he said, just about every small town in California, instead of decreasing in size, has everything now is a suburb of Los Angeles or San Francisco, and these towns, their towns are growing there, and they're not in decline the way they are here. But one of the nice things, regardless of what kind of small town that you live in, is that if you're interested in America, and if you're interested in, especially in class, as I am, as class in America, these are kind of wonderful crucibles to in which to look at this country. In small towns, the rich can't really escape the poor, and vice versa. You know, as in the case of Empire Falls, the children of the richest family in town end up in school with the children of the poorest family in town. And there are ways in which we have to deal with our neighbors on the street in small towns the way people who live in cities and in, you know, gated communities at one end of the social spectrum and in, you know, one form of ghetto or another at the other end of it. In cities, people have ways of you know, walling themselves off from people who are not in their, you know, their economic group or their educational group or whatever. Small towns, people are thrown together. They have to deal with each other, and some pretty interesting things come out of that dynamic. So that's one of the reasons I remain interested.
Yeah, I'm sure that that's why a town like this would be appealing for a writer, because it's the quality of small towns that everybody knows what everybody else is up to, and everybody, because people are packed sort of closely together, and as you say, you can't avoid the other people, there's going to be greater possibility for people's lives to intersect,
right,
in ways that will, you know, present the writer with some interesting possibilities for telling stories.
When somebody's car is parked outside the house, you generally know whose it is.
And there certainly in this novel is a big secret that our hero, Miles, eventually learns, that explains a lot, a big secret about the way in which his family is linked with this, the rich family of the town.
Right. Right. I'm not going to tell that secret on the air.
No. I was just going to open that door to see if you wanted to go through, but I'm not going to pull you through because
there's one other door we're not going to walk through either.
Okay. Okay. Well, that's fine.
We'll get to that.
That's fine. And that's one thing I've now, you know, done doing more and more, I'm having the pleasure of talking more and more with people who write fiction, and the great challenge always is to say something meaningful about the book and not spoil the experience of reading it for the reader,
sure,
which I certainly don't want to do.
And in my books, too, I mean, it's funny because my books are comic novels, but in talking with interviewers, I sometimes wonder afterwards if anybody's going to go out and buy this book because, in fact, when humor is very difficult to talk about, and number two, we always start out talking about dying towns and
right,
people losing their jobs and all of that, and I can almost hear in the background people hanging up, you know, and saying, "There's enough of this in my life. I don't need to read about it in fiction."
And there is a lot of comedy in this book. Actually, last night I started reading Straight Man, which I think is even a funnier book.
Yeah,
and it's one that I definitely think anybody who's a college professor involved in a university community would find. I think they'll find people in that book they know.
I'm sure they will.
And so I'll just leave it at that. We have a caller here who's been very patient. We want to bring them into the conversation. They're down in southeastern Illinois. This is on our line number 4. Hello.
Yes. I'm not familiar with your books and won't be unless they're recorded by the Talking Books programs because macular degeneration has me past the reading point. But I would like to talk just a little bit about the movie made on one of them, Nobody's Fool. I came across that recently on was getting Cinemax then. I think it was run repeatedly on Cinemax. And I think it's a unique movie in a number of ways. In the first place, it's a perfect example, I think, of ensemble acting. I mean, Newman is the star, but everybody in that is good. But more unusual, the work itself is an ensemble work. It's of a piece. There isn't one, two, or three. There aren't one, two, or three outstanding scenes. There aren't any hook scenes. It's just, it's all, as I say, of a piece. I tuned into it two or three times and watched a little bit of it, surfing the channels, and didn't get hooked because there's no hook scene. And then finally, because of the persistence, they kept running it. I watched the whole thing and realized how good it was and gave it the time it deserved. And it has one other unique feature, almost unique, and that is that I think it's a men-oriented film, and practically all, overwhelming majority, virtually all men-oriented films are action films. I mean, there's either violence is either present or potential. I mean, death, injury is imminent or present. And this isn't that way. It's a book of, or a movie of relationships. And my question is, what was your opinion of the movie? Of the movie that they made of your book? Is it quite a bit like the book? And how did it do in the theaters and in video rentals?
I loved the movie. I thought. My standard reply is that every writer should be treated as well as I was treated with that particular movie.
That's good.
The director, Robert Benton, and I have become since then very good friends, and we after that made the movie Twilight that David referred to a moment ago, and we're trying actually to do to get off the ground another project that we're going to do together. Called The Ice Harvest. But I love the movie, and as you say, it is a marvelous ensemble movie. And I'm so glad that you finally sat down and watched it from start to finish, because the individual scenes, good as they are, do have a cumulative effect. So I'm glad you had a chance to put it all in a in a kind of perspective, I think the ending is particularly moving, although the ending is somewhat different from the ending of the novel that I wrote. But it was very true to the spirit of the thing. I have no idea how well I know that the movie did well, especially for a movie of its kind, which is kind of somber and serious, and as you say, that it seems to be, in a way, for men without having any of the things in it that we normally see in supposedly men's movies. But I think it did very well. How well it did on things like video, I have no way of knowing. As a matter of fact, Hollywood has an army of lawyers who work full-time at making sure that nobody knows exactly how much money is coming in or going out. And so I certainly wouldn't know how well it did in financial terms. I keep getting these statements explaining to me why the movie's never made any money, but I know it did.
As I said before, everybody in that, from the little boy to Jessica Tandy, is and is that dedicated to Jessica Tandy?
It is, yes.
Jessica, it said to Jessica, and I assumed that was her.
Yes, yes. Jessica actually was very ill when the movie was shot, and it was a movie that was shot out of sequence, and the Jessica Tandy scenes were filmed first, so she was there for about the first 3 weeks of the shoot, and so the very ending of the movie, for instance, was among the first things that got shot out of sequence. And of course, there's a chilling moment for everybody in the theater because the movie came out shortly after she died. And there's a chilling moment in the movie when the character of Miss Burrell, looking out the window at the falling tree limb, says to Sully, who walks in the door, she says, "I think this is the year that God's going to lower the boom." Hmm. So the character said it, and unfortunately, that was the year that Jessica Tandy died.
I wonder if that had some effect on, in her mind. I mean, you know, I mean, if she... When she said that, she was thinking in.
Well, you know, I don't see how there was any way that she couldn't have been, because she was not ill. She did her scenes in the book. She did her scenes in the movie heroically and never complained to anybody. But I'm sure that she would not have been able to say that line without thinking about it. And I know that there was some thought when the movie was being cut to actually take that line out, because it seemed morbid, of course, knowing the reality. But I think that the general sense was that she would not have wanted that.
No. Well, it's a wonderful movie, and as I said, it's of a piece, because there aren't any hook scenes in it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, thank you.
All right, thanks for the call. I think that's certainly what the caller says about this being a men's movie points to something that is a theme that runs through all of your writing, I think, and that is the relationship between parents and children, and particularly between fathers and sons.
Yeah. This book, actually, Empire Falls, is a book that I was... I'm glad to have written, because I did spend a good deal of time in my early fiction dealing with the fathers and sons, the risk pool, pretty much from the son's point of view, nobody's fool from the father's point of view. Straight Man, because it was an academic novel in some ways, and just pretty much a lark in others, was a departure. But coming to this book, this is very much a father-daughter story. And Tick, Miles' daughter, is my favorite character in this book. And I am myself the father of two daughters who were in high school when I began writing Empire Falls. They're both in college now. Wonderful young women, past the point of having to a father. Well, fathers never stop worrying, of course, but they've survived high school, for which I'm grateful. But this is a bit of a departure too, in that of course there is a father in this book, Max, but really the emphasis is on a father-daughter relationship.
Yeah, Tick is a wonderful character, and as I told my wife last night, I said, you know, this is the kind of teenage daughter that you would wish for.
Yeah, I got two of them, too.
You know, last week I had the opportunity to talk with Ethan Kanan.
One of my favorite writers.
I'm glad to hear that. And we talked about his new novel, Carry Me Across the Water.
It's a great book, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It's a very fine book. And he said something that I thought was really interesting. He was talking about the sense of space in that book particularly, but in writing. And as you know, having read the book, it's the story of this one man and four major sections of his life, each one of those being a story that's told independently, in a way that what Kanan does is he bounces you back and forth in time between each of these four story lines. And he said something very interesting. He talked about the space, the literal space, the white space that's at the end of one chapter before the next one starts. And he talked about the fact that that's in a sense that represents a real space in the story, because there's a jump in space and time.
Right.
But there's also a quality about that book is, and that's the only thing that I guess I could use to describe it, a spaciousness about it. And so after having read that, the next novel I picked up was Empire Falls,
right,
which almost feels claustrophobic compared to that. And maybe in part that says something about these people and small town life, and the fact that everybody is in everybody else's face almost all the time, and you almost can't help but that be the case.
Yeah, and also in excuse me, in my book, there's a similar kind of spaciousness of time that there is in Ethan Kanan's book, because, you know, there are three distinct generations in Empire Falls, all of which are, to my mind anyway, equally important. But in my book, more than in Ethan's, the past has almost a palpable weight. I remember those stories in Carry Me Across the Water, and thinking that the past was important there too, but you never had the past in Ethan's book. You get the sense of the scope of his main character's life, of its length, and the way things are in the past and the present are linked. But you never have that sense of the weight of the past as a weight of something that's bearing down on people. As it happens in Miles's life, there's a point at which the past kind of just punctures right through to the present and begins to dictate the future. And so I think your observation is dead on, that there's not only a sense of the spatial limitation of this town, because even when Miles and Tick at the beginning they're just returning from a vacation from Martha's Vineyard, it seems astonishing for them to have even been able to escape it that much just for a week.
Yeah, and that, yes, and there is that notion that what you're almost rooting for is that the character makes a permanent escape, but you maybe feel in a sort of a sorrowful way in your heart that this is a guy that really, well, and you, I think you said it in one of the interviews that I read, where you said that you said basically you felt that these characters were trapped, and you feel for them because you feel that almost no matter what they do, they're not really going to be able to change their lives very much because they're just stuck.
Yeah, there are limitations to what they can accomplish through their own active participations in their own lives, which I think is probably true of all of us. I mean, the idea of controlling our lives, directing our lives, is a comforting notion. We all subscribe to it. But in fact, you know, though there are times when we suspect that there are more powerful forces at work. Sometimes behind the scenes, sometimes they're economic forces, sometimes they're psychological forces. There are ways that we can and that if we're to live meaningfully, we must impact our own lives, that we must change what can be changed. But it's always a mistake to think that you can change things that you can't change.
Yeah. And so, and for Miles, it takes for him really to make the jump, if only temporarily, it takes a cataclysmic event.
Yes, he must. Miles must come to terms with the past in general, how the past has impacted his present, and in the way that fathers do, has to understand that much of what he's been spinning his wheels over isn't important. And what is important, in order to deal with what can be dealt with, the first thing you have to know is what is important, what means more to you than anything else. Mm-hmm. Because part of what Miles has been troubled by is just the complexity of life, the complexity of all of our lives. There are all sorts of, there are too many things that need to be fixed, and how do you rank them? By the end of the book, he knows how to rank them, and he knows what can be fixed, what can't be fixed, and he knows what's, it's the question of how did I come to be here really isn't important to him anymore. Making sure that which is most important to him in his life gets taken care of.
And that for him would be his daughter.
That would be his daughter.
I guess maybe I should introduce again our guest. We've been talking here for a while. I just want to make sure people who are listening know who we're talking to. We're speaking with Richard Russo. He's a novelist, and he has written several, including Mohawk, The Risk Pool, Nobody's Fool, which, as we've discussed, was made into a movie with Paul Newman, and Straight Man. Those are all available in paperback. His newest is published by Knopf. It's Empire Falls. And your questions are welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. I think, rightly so, many reviewers of your work have pointed out how good you are with dialogue. I think it is on the one hand feels real, as if people actually could say this, although it's very snappy, and sometimes it's the sort of things that you read and you think, I wish I had said that. Or, you know, you can imagine yourself in that situation. It's the thing you say, yeah, I wish I could come up with a line like that. And going back to the thing I said earlier, I think where I said I thought what was compelling about your characters is that they're very ordinary, and they are, and yet they're very verbally skillful. So in that way, maybe they're not quite as ordinary as the rest of us. How do you think about dialogue, and do you, try to go around with your ears really open and listen for things, and then try to keep them and use them later?
Excuse me. Dialogue is the thing that has always come most naturally to me. And there are some paradoxes to dialogue and writing good dialogue. Students, when I was teaching fiction writing not that long ago, students were always asking me what the secret to dialogue was, and it's actually fairly simple. You just kind of have to remember in the back of your mind that it's an illusion. In the sense that people want what they call realistic dialogue, but the truth of it is that the more realistic you make dialogue, the worse it is, and that's the paradox. I mean, tape sometime a bunch of people in a room, or you know, just a dinner party or something. Just tape without telling people. you'll want to destroy the tape later too, but just tape people talking and then type it up, what they say, and type it up with all the uhs and you know, the false starts and the sentences that begin and then begin a second time and the wrong word that's used and all of that. You know, type it up as a transcript, look at it, and you'll find that it is, number one, it'll seem unrealistic, and number two, it'll be dull. And those are the things that you want to avoid in writing good dialogue. Good dialogue is actually the most artificial of all the various techniques of fiction. And so, but once you get that in your head, that it is that it is artificial and that it's not going to be heard, but rather it's going to be seen on the page. In real life, we hear dialogue, and in a book, we see it, and the eye and the ear are very different instruments. You make it. It's not a question of making it realistic. It's a question of making not so much what the character says in terms of information, but you just want to make sure that the character's attitude is always up front. You know, not just what he says, but you know why he says it, and what the you can imagine the inflection of his or her voice in saying such a thing. You know, if you just keep those things in mind, most people can write good dialogue pretty easily, but until you learn those things, it's always going to sound stiff, stilted, written.
There is near the end of the novel a big event that and I wonder how, and again I don't want to say exactly what it is, but there is a violent event.
Yeah.
And I wonder how you thought about that and how you thought about it, using it, because some people would say that it's almost cheating in a way by taking something that we have seen happen that's so real.
Right.
It's almost,
right.
In fact, we've almost seen so much of it in real life that now it almost becomes a cliche.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and there is an act of violence near the end of this book that caused me no end of concern, because I had a pretty good idea I was heading there from the start.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that I didn't want to write this scene, that I didn't want to go where I was going, was probably more than anything else what convinced me that was where I had to go. You know, the thing about any act of violence, and this particular act of violence, is that when we see violence, and this is, as they say, something wrenched from today's headlines, the way this is usually referred to. But when something like that happens and we see it on the news, and we ask the question, how could such a thing have happened in our community, in our town, whatever. Why is that we didn't see, see this coming? Those are questions that tend to be answered as you know, in the days that follow any such event, whether it's Timothy McVeigh's bombing or whatever. We say, you know, why, how. And unfortunately, as we continue to watch the news slack-jawed, the answers that are given to us are almost always either political or sociological. You know, the people on the left will say, well, here's the cause of violence, and it's this. And then people on the right will say, well, no, that's not the cause of such violence. The cause of such violence is this. And then we start listening to things that's couched in a kind of academic sociological language that has a kind of element of truth to it, but what it never does is what those answers never provide is a sense of number one, what does it feel like? And provides a question, an answer to the question, in a way that makes us feel like we truly understand the various forces, which may even be contradictory, may not fall into any neat political philosophy or social philosophy. And this is what novels do, perhaps better than any other medium, I think, is to make us understand at some level at which political explanations and social explanations leave us unsatisfied. And that's the only justification that I can think of for a book, or the best justification for, and to express the need for instance, a book like Crime and Punishment, in which the main character, Raskolnikov, murders very graphically, a helpless old woman. Why in the, and what it provides for us is not a, you know, it's not a a political, and while it is kind of a philosophical novel, it's really not even, it's not even a philosophical explanation of why Raskolnikov does what he does. There's a huge social landscape of that novel, but it's not really explained in sociological terms. What you're asked to do is live it. And what I'm hoping is that people who read this book and read that chapter, which is not an easy chapter, what they're going to come away with some sort of knowledge that you don't get from television explanations. What I'm trying to force everybody to do is to live an event. That's what novels do better than just about anything else, I think.
Hmm. In a couple of the things I've read about you, you have made references to how difficult writing is, that it's very hard work. And certainly Mr. Kanin said the same thing. And I think probably a lot of writers will say that with some degree of emphasis. You know, some maybe make that as a stronger statement than others. But, having said all that, I guess some people would say, well, if it's so hard, if it's such a painful process, why do it? So for you, what would the answer to that question be?
It's the easiest question that I can imagine in terms of stating it. And like all the easy good questions, I have no answer for it. I'm not sure how hard writing is. I may have said that and may have even believed it when I said it. It is hard at times, and there are degrees of difficulty. Straight Man, the novel before this one, was a lark. There were some dark undercurrents to it, but the comedy was just. I had enormous fun writing that book, and I still look back at it as a tremendously enjoyable process. It's a book that I didn't make any significant wrong turns in. It feels now, looking back at it, just as this great gift that was given to me. This book, on the other hand, seemed to exact at least a pound of flesh, and part of it was because I was going to a darker place than I had ever been before. It frightened me, but it's, you know, that's one of the things that if you aspire to write something that will last beyond your lifetime, it's probably going to involve sex and death and virtually everything that causes us as human beings pain and which causes us to search for meaning in our lives. The most honest answer to your question is that in some way, visiting such a dark place and emerging from the other end, at the other end of it, and feeling that the journey was worth it, is rewarding. If Dostoevsky felt that there was any way writing Crime and Punishment that he wasn't going to come out the other end, you know, that he wasn't going to survive the experience, he wouldn't have done it. If I didn't think I was going to survive the writing of Empire Falls, which terrified me in some ways, I wouldn't have done it. I felt that I could do it, that the journey would be very difficult, and that ultimately it would be okay, and it would be far better, certainly, than having to live any of the experiences that I was writing about.
Mm. So, at the outset, not only did you know that you something about the story that you wanted to tell, and it would be a big story, and there would be a big cast of characters, and there would be a lot of technical challenges. You did have a sense of where you were going to end up, and what you and the characters and the reader all would be going through the book.
probably a better sense of it than in this book than I do in most books, because in most of my novels I don't have a very good sense of where I'm going. The level of anxiety that I felt about where this might be going suggested to me from pretty early on that this is where I was heading. You don't get that worried about something that probably won't come into play.
Yeah.
So in this book, at least, but there was a lot of things I didn't know. I didn't know, for instance, I didn't know the details of the violence. I knew I was going to a violent place, but I didn't know who the victims of that violence were going to be, and that made me was another element mm-hmm. of the difficulty.
Well, we're going to have to stop, I'm sorry to say, because we've used our time. I want to say thanks very much for talking with us. We'd certainly appreciate
it. I enjoyed it.
And I thought it was a terrific book, so I appreciate you giving us the time. And once again, for people who are listening, our guest Richard Russo, and all of his books are available. The previous novels, The Mohawk, The Risk Pool, Nobody's Fool, Straight Man, they're all on paper. The new one is now out in hardcover by Knopf, Empire Falls. And again, thanks very much.
Thank you.